Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here today with fellow producer Julia O'Donohue and a old friend of ours, Greg Wyshynski, Puck Daddy himself, or Mr. Puck Daddy. Somebody pointed out, I said that I was going to be interviewing Puck Daddy. I said, well, how could you interview a website? So, you know, that's what happens when you enter the Twitter stream.
Yeah.
Welcome. You used to work with us at the Connection newspapers in Northern Virginia. You were a managing sports editor. Pretty big deal. And then you went on to work for Yahoo.
Yep.
And found the Puck Daddy site, which in the hockey world is a pretty big deal.
Didn't at Deadspin.
I did, yeah. So yeah. The long and short of it was that, and don't shortchange my time as the arts editor, sir, at the Connection newspapers.
Restaurant reviews were killing.
When I was working at the paper, like at the same time I was writing hockey on the side, like I had this whole other thing. So it was like before the two-screen experience became something everybody did when they're watching television at night, like that was my experience at work. Like I worked on the iMac. Mm-hmm. And then I had my laptop open and was doing like some hockey stuff at the same time.
Yeah.
The benefit of working at a weekly newspaper. So that sort of transitioned into writing for some magazines, writing for some hockey sites. The big break was going to AOL Sports, which at one point was a content creator of its own and not just the thing that bought the Huffington Post. And worked at a thing called Fan House. And then I worked at Deadspin, as Julie mentioned, for about 6 months, waking mm-hmm. up every morning and writing a review of the night's hockey action in the Deadspin form, which was a challenge, which meant scouring the internet for bikini pictures of girls in hockey bikinis. And then I got headhunted by Yahoo in April 2008.
Oh, cool.
And
so
you wrote a book.
A very funny book.
Yes, the best reviewed bathroom book in the history of sports journalism, which is the claim I make because no one else would ever attempt to make it.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm safe.
No, and it is quite good bathroom reading.
Yeah. Oh, Glow Pucks and 10-cent beer, by the way, all those out there scouring Amazon right now for my name. Glow Pucks and 10-cent beer, the 101 worst ideas in sports history. Of the 5 reviews on Amazon, 4 are mostly positive, and I think it's in the millions right now in the rankings because it came out several years ago.
But still a good read nonetheless for people who like sports, but also people who like to read funny criticism of stupid things in sports.
Yes.
So it's sort of like the last, the top 10 worst plays on ESPN or whatever. And
yes.
Just multiplied. Because people like lists.
That's funny you should say that because the book was born when I was at a magazine and the 101 worst ideas in sports history was going to be, and I will whip out a journalism term, the double truck in the magazine.
Ooh.
In the middle of the, I know, right? And I bought my editor this list and it was just 101 things with a snarky little sentence after each one. So I was like a decade before BuzzFeed.
You had 101 tweets.
Right. So yeah, exactly.
You're ready
right.
to go.
And I took it to my editor and he said, we're not going to do it. I'm like, why? He's like, because people don't like lists. I'm like, you're out of your mind. So I turned it into a book and sold it really well.
So tell us sort of about Puck Daddy and what that's kind of become, because it is kind of a big deal. I mean, you're an authority in the hockey realm. People follow you.
Greg is being modest and probably won't mention that you are I'm going to forget what your ranking is, 84th, somewhere around there?
Oh, on the hockey news list?
Yes.
I am number 93, I think, 93rd most influential and powerful person in hockey, although I dropped a spot.
Mm.
Oh. So my influence is clearly waning.
So if you suddenly see
I don't remember.
A strange spree of 92... related hockey,
yeah,
unusual deaths. We know
just
came,
oh exactly. Oh yeah, to get back up to the top. It was the hockey news list that comes out every year. I started at 100, mm-hmm. Which I felt
hanging on by.
Yeah, and I felt like I was the first blogger to ever make the list. So I felt like that was the novelty. It was like when Entertainment Weekly puts Carrot Top as the 100th most powerful entertainer in the world. It's like now everybody will be like, why is he on the list? But then eventually, like, kind of inched up a little bit. It's a really cool honor. I mean, like, I'm more happy with the idea of them honoring that form of media and the influence of that form of media than I am, you know, seeing my stupid face in the magazine.
Now, you were, you know, working with you at the paper, it was pretty obvious that you were a hockey fan. You were particularly a New Jersey Devils fan.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you were able to find a venue where you could do your dream job, I guess. Is this your dream job or one of your dream jobs?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I never really had anything. Like when I was a kid, my dream job was being like a color commentator or an analyst or something like that. But I don't really have the playing background, let's say, to pull that one off.
You don't sound like you're from Canada.
Yeah, it's like when I was a kid, I wanted to be on like the NFL Today, but like I'm not, you know, Michael Strahan or anything. Like I don't have that kind of gravitas. But no, it's a dream job in the sense that like I think every writer, most writers, I'd say, want something where they can kind of like carve out their own niche and have their own sandbox and not have someone breathing down their neck, which again was at the paper. Like, you know, my whole thing was the mantra I had to everybody was like, let's work as hard as we can to keep the heat off of us and just mm-hmm. have our own little piece of heaven that we can play with and not have people saying, well, you should be writing this. And with Puck Daddy, it's great because Yahoo Sports allows me to kind of have whatever journalistic approach we want to do. They've really helped out in facilitating ideas and they're not really all that hands on. They're like, if this works, we'll just let you manage this. And that's great. I mean, to be able to have that autonomy is more of a dream job than the subject matter.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that writing in the digital realm was sort of an easier thing for you to do, or did it open up avenues that you didn't really sort of imagine?
It's a different thing to do. I mean, in the sense that like, you know, my only frame of reference is working at the weekly paper. So as an editor now for a site with a 24-hour news cycle, it's a much more challenging thing. I mean, my plate became three times as full because now all of a sudden I'm not only managing staff and writing for myself, but I'm also kind of monitoring and making sure that everything runs on time. And you know, there's a competitive aspect to it as well where you have people coming after you and you're trying to keep up with other people and that sort of thing. So it's a very – it's an exhilarating job, but I mean, I think it's much more challenging than the newspaper gig, just because of the immediacy of it, and sometimes the stakes involved. I guess I don't know. When you're running your own shop, I guess there's more stakes involved than when you're working for a couple of other people.
Mm-hmm. Can you, for people who aren't familiar with it, can you describe the site?
Yeah, sure. So the site's called Puck Daddy. When I took over the site in April 2008, it was called the NHL Experts Blog, which is a name that I miss.
Terrible.
Incredible hubris of that name. But then working with a guy named Jamie Mottram, who's considered to be one of the forefathers of sports blogging, we sort of developed the site together and came up with the name together. And so the site essentially is it runs every day, and I try to run it where if you get into work at 8 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast, you will have something new to read every hour until you leave. And then at night, if you're home watching the game, if something happens, there will also be coverage of that. So it really is a site that runs on a 24-hour basis whenever there is news to cover. And the approach of the site really is kind of a combination of making sure that you are informed on every piece of hockey news out there. A lot of analysis, but on top of that, a lot of personality, and on top of that, a lot of whimsy. I mean, like we really do try to balance the hard news and analysis with just goofy stuff, because essentially that's why sports works, is that it's the sublime and the ridiculous. It's the really big story that, you know, kind of like mirrors society's problems, and then also a mascot sitting on a hat, you know, it's
right.
Like, you know, that kind of stuff is the thing that we love. So we really try to balance out the stuff that's a little bit more analytical and newsworthy with stuff that's clearly there just there for entertainment.
Well, and that's one of the appeals about sports, is that it's you know, the people are going to hold you to your facts. They want to make sure you get the news and the facts correct, and
right,
they can come to you and get all that stuff. But they also want to be entertained.
Right.
But some people don't. I'm going to say some people don't get that, like not quite the way Greg does. I mean, like sometimes you go on Greg's site and there's things like that guy who lived in Vermont who painted someone's office the color of the Bruins.
Yeah.
Like, and I think he was a Canadiens fan.
Yeah.
I mean, like some people take themselves really seriously in the sports world. It's like, you know,
well,
like big booming voice seriously.
I think the issue for me with that has always been that, like, I've always considered sports writing to be a form of entertainment writing. And maybe that's because when I grew up in Jersey and my dad would bring home the New York Daily News, it would go like this. You open the front cover, here is all the news, mm-hmm. and then you get to gossip, and then you get to opinion, and now you're in entertainment, then you're in classified, and now you're in sports, right. and then you're in television.
Right.
So that was the structure of the paper, and to me it was always like, okay, well, after the entertainment comes the sports, because that's all the diversionary
right.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever begrudge anybody trying to cover sports or entertainment, any form of entertainment, with a critical eye and with an eye towards big issues, because there are issues of gender and disparity and race and economic disparity and all this other stuff inherent in sports. But I feel like sometimes when people write that giant 10,000 word personality story or feature story, like it's a really forced attempt to try to legitimize what is essentially a frivolous venture, and I'm not everybody agrees with me on that in my sports writing brethren, but like to me there's always that aspect of it is we're trying to make ourselves seem more important and relevant because when we work in the newsroom we look over at someone like Julie and she's writing this really important stuff that's
right.
like life or death and taxes and we're writing about a softball game so that's always been kind of a thing for me too.
Well, like, and the poor professional athlete who does something illegal or wrong and then suddenly the broadcasters are all super serious and,
right.
and being critical and the bringing in the weight of it that it's a completely different tone than what sports generally is.
There's a balance to it. And I think that on Puck Daddy, we try to strike that balance. And all the Yahoo sports blogs try to strike that balance because there are real issues. I mean, like this entire issue of concussions in the National Football League
right.
is a very real human issue that trickles down all the way to youth sports. And I mean, there are very big, important issues in sports. But the idea that you can't have fun with it. Or the idea that like you can't show a highlight of a impactful body check in hockey and also write the important story about concussions. I think that you can strike that balance, but sometimes there's this criticism of those of us who decide to maybe err on the side of whimsy.
And right, and you guys on Puck Day, there's long form stuff too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. No, it's a journalistic venture. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why the blog worked so well so early is that like there because I started the thing in 2008 and the world's changed a lot in the last 5 years mm-hmm. when it comes to alternative media. To say you were a blogger in 2008 meant you didn't get a phone call back because that was the perception of the form. And the perception of you as a blogger. And I think one of the reasons why the blog works so well is because it became clear quite early that I did have almost a decade of journalistic experience with newspapers. I had other guys on my staff with the same sort of thing. And so you came to the site maybe expecting it to just be what blogs, quote unquote, were back then, which is the regurgitation of AP copy in a lot of ways. And then you came away thinking, oh, okay, so they are picking up the phone and calling somebody, or they are going to the game and going to the locker room and getting interviews. Like there was that aspect of the sports journalism that people have come to appreciate in mainstream sports that was there on the blog from the beginning.
Yeah, people appreciate work, hard work that goes into something. People can pick up on mm-hmm. that sort of effort that you put into it and appreciate that.
Yeah.
And, that pays dividends because those people come back, those people talk to other people, and then they tie into all the other stuff that you're doing as well.
Right, and you do a lot of multi-platform stuff. I mean, you have a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be honest, that's probably mostly how I consume news about hockey.
Is from the podcast?
Through your podcast. There's something about – I feel bad if I'm at work and I am looking at something that's, like, not hard news. I do not feel bad when I'm, like, riding the train.
Right.
Listening to whatever the hell I'm listening to on my pocket – on my iPod. And you're on TV, too.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. The podcasting thing, it's a show called Merrick versus Wyszynski. M-A-R-E-K is my partner's name. He's this guy, Jeff Merrick, who's on the Canadian equivalent of ESPN SportsCenter pretty much up in Canada on a network called Sportsnet. And it's a daily podcast. We do it from 2 to 3 live so people can stream it on the site. But then also people find it on iTunes afterwards. And it's really opened up the audience experience for me in a way that I never thought it could. I mean, the interaction that we get on that show eclipses the interaction that I have with readers, and it's immediate because we put out Twitter questions. People will then come back the next morning and ask us about the show because they'll listen to it on their commute. It really is one of the more fulfilling experiences I've had as a professional, just doing that podcast every day, and not in a form that allows us, much like this, to allows mm-hmm. you to, on, allows for tangents, allows for the freedom of form. The TV stuff's been fun. Like the TV stuff, I've done several things. The local Comcast affiliate here in DC, I've done panel work for them, talking about the Capitals. And some stuff here and there for them. Sportsnet in Canada, I've worked on their trade deadline show the last 2 years. And for those who don't know the trade deadline in the National Hockey League, it is a day-long experience.
Think NFL draft.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, it's like the show begins at like 8 a.m. and then they run live content covering the trade deadline until about 9 at night. It's amazing. So they had me on. Last year was a little frustrating. This year was more fun than last year because this year actually we did some good analysis and stuff like that. The first year was just like, here's the blog guy reading tweets. but that TV stuff's been great. And then through Yahoo's partnership with NBC, I'm going to be doing a lot more TV this year. Like they're there's a daily show that Yahoo brands with NBC at noon weekdays called Sports Dash. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to have a weekly role on that show doing hockey stuff. And then whenever hockey news breaks, I think I'm going to be like their go-to guy, which is
great.
Are
you going to be on NBC Sports?
That's the plan. Like I did some stuff with NBC last year on the digital side that was sort of maybe like a pilot episode. Me and their hockey bloggers kind of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks. And the format worked great. Like I was really happy with the end result. So maybe that gets drafted into some of their pregame stuff or whatever. But I don't envision myself being on the same panel as like, Jeremy Roenick and Mike Milbury and the hockey pundits. But I think they're probably.
I really want you to be sitting to like the left of Mike Milbury, please.
But I think there's going to be some role for me on their stuff. The Yahoo NBC relationship looks pretty positive, and I know that they're a huge fan of the content that we provide. And obviously, me being the lead blogger for hockey and also having some experience in digital media, I think it'll be beneficial.
Now you were at the Olympics last summer? Or this
I went to both Vancouver and London.
Okay.
Vancouver as a hockey writer, and that remains the single most incredible experience I've ever had as a professional. Like the waking up at 9 o'clock in the morning and watching hockey until midnight, and not just hockey, but like all star hockey, like the best hockey, was amazing. And that was my first Olympics, and it really was a different experience than London because I was in my comfort zone. London, I don't still know why they brought me to London. Like
what
London,
were you writing in London?
Well, because here's the thing, right? Like you remember on Survivor?
Where's the hockey?
You remember on Survivor when like one guy would learn how to catch the fish and then they couldn't get rid of him because he's too valuable? Like in London, I became sort of the man about town. In Vancouver, rather, I became sort of the man about town culture writer along with being the hockey guy. So like I would write stories about the swag available in the department stores, what the bars were doing, little things, finding quirky fans at events, that kind of thing. And Yahoo was really impressed with that coverage. And so when they wanted to bring that aspect of the coverage to London, mm-hmm. they thought I'd be the guy. Also beneficial to me was the fact that it's the summer and there's no hockey. so, hey, we're paying this guy. So, so it worked out really well where I was sort of like the man about town covering the cultural aspects of hosting the games, but also like being that I have this journalistic background in sports writing that goes beyond hockey and have covered boxing and have covered all these other sports, I basically covered every sport outside of basketball, swimming, and track and field. Like every equestrian I covered, like it was really great. And the benefit to me obviously is that I don't have a lot of virtues, but two of them are sort of a versatility in writing and then also speed. Mm-hmm. And so those two things combined when you're covering the Olympics really are sort of a benefit to have somebody on the ground like that.
Yeah, Greg, can we talk about your output? Because I feel like you're on the podcast every day, which I'm assuming takes some prep.
Yeah, a phone call.
I don't know how many times you post a day, but it's several. And I don't know if you have to look at other people's content that goes up, but
typical day is I would say I write between 6 and 10 things of varying lengths. Most of them longer than I probably should, being that it's a blog.
Right.
The other guy, I have two other guys who write for the site, Sean Leahy and Harrison Mooney, and they both post their own stuff. I will read it after publication. I don't read it before publication because I trust them in their reporting and also in their grammar. Although Harrison's from Canada and he puts U's in all the words. but I write between 6 to 10 things, do the podcast, and
then you're often on something else, like
Twitter.
You're on like another another podcast. I'm assuming other radio shows.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. it's a full gig. I mean, like the radio stuff that I do. I have a regular gig with the local ESPN affiliate here in DC, where I do 4 hits a week on the Capitals, mm-hmm. and then occasionally host a show for them. I'd say about half dozen regular radio gigs every week, and then right. people, you know, call up and stuff. Right. And it's interesting because, like, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are you know, in my shoes that have, you know, time consuming gigs, and I don't think they necessarily do as much radio as I do. And by that I mean, like, yeah, when the station in Toronto calls, like, I'm going to obviously go on that station because it's the big flagship station in Toronto. But, like, you know, I do Honolulu, I do Montgomery, Alabama, I do, like, Sarasota, Florida. Like, I part of the whole thing for me in writing Puck Daddy and being a hockey writer is, you know, hockey is everywhere, and you have to – the more that you can serve those audiences and the more that you give those people a chance to interact and be part of the community and stuff and feel like it's their game too, even though they don't have a team in their region – it's a good thing. So, like, right. whenever I get a quote unquote like non-traditional market asking me to come on the radio, like, I enjoy that more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I think it also helps that when you write for Yahoo, you are balanced. It's a balancing act between writing for hockey nerds and writing for the most general audience you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, when my stuff goes on the front page of Yahoo.com, it is being seen by everybody. So I can't simply just assume that readership knows all of the references and all of the jokes or even the game itself. So I had this experience of being able to cater to a really hardcore hockey nerd audience that's going to listen to my podcast every day, but then also cater to a more general audience. And I think that's allowed me to connect with a lot of different audiences when I do like radio hits or TV stuff.
I think that that's like important in terms of how digital journalism or the digital world has affected sports consumption. I mean, like, I'm someone who never listened to sports talk radio for a couple of different reasons. One, I'm primarily a hockey fan, and here it was like Redskins all the time. And then also, I mean, not to get like soapboxy about this, but it was pretty misogynistic. I mean, it's
totally.
It was really not speaking to me. And, you know, like, you can talk a little bit about like totally going your tangent about boobs or Wayne Gretzky's daughter or whatever is going on that day. But you know, like, I think one of the great things about – I have become a much more avid fan, I think, for a couple different reasons. But one of them is there are more outlets that are catering to what I want.
Right.
You know, I mean, Greg's podcast is not the only one I listen to, and his site's not the only one I go to. But it's just definitely the misogyny is like – down a lot. And then in this area, I wasn't going to get a hockey show in the middle of the day.
Right.
It just mm-hmm. was not going to happen.
Right.
So.
And that was, and it's, you know, we have a few, I've established a few foundational things about the site that I've always wanted the mission to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of them obviously is always provide accurate information and, you know, depth of reporting. But the other thing is to just kind of like be a community, like grow a community, like be a part of the larger hockey community, but then also kind of like develop our own community. And I think we've been really successful with that, where people come to the site every day out of habit because they like it and they interact with other readers. And the podcast is a perfect example of that. I mean, like, we did a meetup in New York during the NHL draft, and we had like 250 people show up at this bar. And they were just listeners and fans of the blog. Like, there was no like formal invitation process or anything. It was just sort of like, hey, we're having a party, come see us. and it worked out that way. Can I, Sports Talk Radio made me think of something. And I don't
sure.
want, I don't want to dominate the conversation, but
please.
there was an article that came out recently about the hot take. And so the hot take, for those who don't know, in sports writing is the snap judgment. Make everything black and white, heroes or villains.
Right.
You know, go after the guy with all guns blazing, don't go for nuance, the hot take. And this sort guy's of
a,
argument
point counterpoint
like,
that Skip you'd Bayless have in news,
is like...
yeah, a Skip Bayless thing, or the kind of thing on ESPN that makes you cringe when it's there's no nuance. So either Tim Tebow is Jesus or Tim Tebow is the devil, and why can't he be both? Right? Yeah.
This is
well,
America.
No, he is both to me. When he was a Jet, he was Jesus. Now he's a patriot. Now he's the devil.
There we go.
But this guy's, and I apologize for not remembering what the article was, but if you look up Hot Take in Sports, you might find it. His premise was that it was alternative media and blogs that have sort of dumbed down discourse to the point where that's all that exists. But to me, like, it was like the history of the hot take is what it was, or the evolution of the hot take.
I don't know about that.
But your point about sports talk radio to me is the salient one, because to me, well before blogs started, well before digital media really became so prevalent and everybody became their own sort of like amateur journalist, it was sports talk radio that changed sports journalism. Like when newspaper columnists had to start competing with a guy named Mad Dog who's in the middle of the day screaming about the Yankees, that changed their tone. They had to match that, because now all of a sudden you had your audience gravitating to this other form, and you had to respond in kind. So already the discourse had sort of become something different than what it used to be when you had guys like Frank DeFord writing flowery stuff in the 1980s. And I think blogs sort of just became the next evolution in that form where, there's an audience that's not being served in a certain way. They gravitate to this new thing. And then once again, mainstream media transforms itself to adapt. Insofar as I think back to when I started writing in – the middle of the last decade, the Washington Post didn't cover the Capitals all that well.
No.
Right. And then so all of a sudden, all of these blogs started to pop up. And to the credit of the owner, Ted Leonsis, he was a big proponent of that. So they propped up, fans gravitated towards them, and then now the Washington Post has hockey blog, and Washington Post upped its coverage, and every other paper started covering the Capitals more too. And I think that was it, just like sports talk radio served a segment of the audience that wasn't being served, blogs are the same thing. And I don't think you could say that the blogs have sort of like degraded the conversation into something unintelligible. I just think that the audience wants what it wants.
We were talking about podcasts before we actually started recording here, and the beauty about podcasts is you can find something that speaks to you.
Right.
And I think that the digital realm gives you a place where there are all types of sports coverage, all types of hockey and football,
right,
and types of coverage. So you can find people that are going to deliver a message in the way that you want to get it more than you're going to find them in print and probably TV. So
I mean, you can even just consuming the game. So I lived in Chicago for 2 years, and I had what's it called? Game Center?
Game Center, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the one on TV?
No.
Oh, the one on the internet. Yeah, Game Center, yeah.
Because I didn't own a TV.
Game Center, by the way, is the NHL.com's streaming thing.
Service.
Streaming service, pay-per-view service, yeah.
Which, as long as you're not in market for the game, so I couldn't get the Blackhawks on my computer, but I could get the Capitals, and I'm getting it with my home announcers, which is like maybe a blessing and a curse.
a terrible call.
That's really nice. I was in South Africa for 5 months. My friend Carly, she's probably going to listen to this, she woke up at 4 a.m. every time the Blackhawks played.
That's awesome.
And watched it through, I think, Slingbox.
Yeah.
There are, now you can be in South Africa and watch a game. Like, trust me, that wasn't happening before.
No.
I'm not, I've watched hockey, but I'm not a professed hockey fan as you both are. But, at least, I perceive that for a very long time, hockey had sort of the Chicago sort of second city attitude is in the sports world, that we're not the NFL yet, we're not MLB, but we've got a lot to offer.
Yeah.
So I think when you have an audience that's like that, that's appreciative like that, when you start speaking to them and bringing them content that's geared towards them, they're gonna give back.
Yeah, but there's also that aspect of it too. I mean, like, part of the experience of being a hockey fan is the sort of we're all in this together aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the things that allowed me and the blog to connect to an audience so quickly was, when you live in Canada, you have no frame of reference for what it is to be a hockey fan in the U.S., like, that you're ghettoized, that you're the last highlight on ESPN SportsCenter, that you can't find any news in the paper. Like in Canada, like you walk out the door and you're just like, hockey. And then like people just run up and start talking to you about hockey. And it's not like that in the U.S. at all. And you know, I am by no means the first American hockey writer. And by no means am I some sort of vanguard of American hockey writing. But our blog was one of the first to really kind of like do this form of journalism from a very American aspect. Well, and I have a really large Canadian readership that in some ways treats me like a scrappy puppy and doesn't think – they think, oh, like the cute American. He didn't really know about hockey, but he's funny. but like we were able to cultivate this really big American following because you know, not a lot of outlets were writing for them and understood the experience – that they have where they felt marginalized by mainstream media that didn't cover hockey or had to read every single year the same column about some mainstream guy who doesn't watch but one hockey game every 4 years when the Olympics roll around talking about, well, if you only banned fighting, and obviously everybody would watch. And it's just like, you know, someone to not only kind of speak to that audience and talk about hockey in those terms, but also be an advocate for the sport and say, you know what? This guy who wrote this story in the New York Times about hockey doesn't know what he's talking about because he hasn't seen a game in 5 years. You know, to have someone who would call BS on that kind of thing too, I think was one of the things that really made us stand out.
Well, I think probably outside of USA Today, there wasn't a lot of league-wide coverage from an American perspective.
Right, yeah.
Like a lot of the league-wide coverage was from a Canadian perspective, totally fine. But, you know, that means that you're getting a lot more information about, I guess, certain Canadian teams.
I'm sure that was a decision of the U.S. or the New York Times or whoever, just saying, oh, we need somebody to cover this. Let's just get this Canadian to write about it. And
But I mean, just even like Greg does league-wide coverage, which is nice. I think in strong hockey markets like in Boston or certainly
Pittsburgh.
Detroit or Pittsburgh, they have really awesome local coverage. Yeah. And then the rest of us are like, you know,
well, you
kind of
really.
In the dark.
Right.
You can't really compete with that. I mean, the perspective and the access that a lot of the local press people are going
to
have.
It's really the most challenging thing, though, of being a national writer is trying to balance that. Like, you don't want to go to the well too many times with a team like Pittsburgh, even though they are a lightning rod of a team. And you know,
and the rest of us care about
it. And especially because, like, you know, being based in D.C., one of my writers is based in New York. Like, it's a East Coast bias is a thing. and we make a concerted effort to try to write about the Western Conference. Luckily, our third writer is based in Vancouver. But it becomes difficult sometimes because I don't know if this is the same thing in almost every other sport, but like, and I know it's not the same in basketball because obviously the West Coast is huge in the NBA. But in hockey, like the Northeast stronghold plus maybe Detroit. That's it. I mean, like, that is where most – Chicago now, too. That is where most of the huge franchises are, where most of the stars play, where most of the fan bases are. I mean, it becomes a situation where
Hey, I know they're small and scrappy, but you better include Minnesota in there.
I'll include Minnesota in there, too. I mean, they're not a winning team yet.
Yeah,
but, like,
exactly.
that definitely there. But you know what I mean? It's like we have to make sure that we write about California because there's a huge fan base in California. But – It's so easy sometimes to just be like, all right, what Sidney Crosby, go, you know, and it's like that kind of thing.
And there's a time issue too. I mean, watching a game at 10 or 10:30, I'm sure wears on you.
Well, yeah,
but you know, it's hockey. He's up for hockey. It's
like
he's
up for hockey.
Doing his homework or something. Yeah. Well, I guess in a sense, his homework. How did the strike affect you as far as you know your coverage? You know, trying to keep you know. The hockey in people's mind when maybe you didn't always have a lot of information to report.
Well, I liked this summer better than last summer because I ain't a lawyer and I ain't an accountant. So it completely changes coverage. I mean, you are dealing much more with the legal ease of a collective bargaining agreement. You know, our coverage of that wasn't as in-depth as maybe you would find it in other places only because I don't have that level of analysis to understand percentages of escrow and you know salary cap tax all those other stuff. You know, like I just don't have the acumen to get that. So I would find people that did or find sources that did to cover those specific issues and really try to keep it at the broad strokes and say, okay, this is why this is important. Here's what the players want. Here's what the owners want. And here's why I think this side is right and this side is wrong. And then also, obviously, kind of getting into the personalities involved in the dispute as well. It was difficult. And
there's no hockey going on.
Yeah. I mean, to our credit, I think that we did a really good job keeping things fresh and not making the coverage monotonous. But it's a very tough thing to write about a sport that doesn't play sports.
In a sense, it's the same story spread out over
it kind of is
over months.
Yeah, and then there's like hope, and then there's dashed hopes, and then you know it's a public negotiation, and anyone who's ever been in a negotiation knows that like you get to the cliff, and then you both back away, and then that's happening every couple of weeks, and it becomes just taxing. And then the other thing too is that like you know this is the second lockout I've covered. To the shame of all hockey fans, that this has now happened twice in 8 years.
You're not particularly that old.
It's, yeah, I know. I know. It's 8 years.
Back in 18-aught.
I've seen three in my lifetime, which is insane. Relationships get fractured. Like people on both sides of the negotiating table that you consider friends and that you consider sources, you know, you're writing hypercritical things about them while they're in a pressure cooker.
Right.
And so there's a lot of sort of fence mending and that has to happen after that process is done, because undoubtedly somebody's been offended by something you've written.
This is a little bit off point, but there was an amazing situation, Mike, during the lockout where all these journalists were outside the headquarters, and they hadn't been fed in hours, and they were all like angry and seething. It was hilarious.
Yeah, and so I think the league bought them pizza. But like it became a thing, like just to just
feed the journalists.
Yeah, just so you can understand how insane things got during like this work stoppage where hockey writers all of a sudden find that they've got nothing to write about but this monotony. The empty podium at press conferences, because they spent so much time in that room staring at this thing, became its own celebrity. There's a Twitter feed called NHL Podium, and where the Twitter feed is like, I wish someone would stand up behind me and talk. The level of psychosis was off the charts. Like you could probably write a dissertation on how crazy people got during the lockout.
Are you going to Sochi?
I am going to Sochi. Yeah.
What's Sochi?
Sochi's Winter Olympics in 2014. Sorry. Winter Olympics this year.
Mr. Out of the
Loop. I'm going to go with our NHL writer Nick Costaneka. So we'll probably share coverage, and I'll probably also do sort of like the cultural stuff too. But it's going to be an incredible challenge because I don't speak Russian.
Right.
And I lucked out the last two Olympics that I covered. My only two Olympics that they were in a suburb of Seattle. and in London, so two places that definitely speak the Queen's English. So I will be challenged, I think, a little bit more by this one, insofar as like the stuff away from the rink.
Hey, Greg, were you the first? Speaking of Russian, were you the first or one of the first people to have? So one of the great things Greg did early on for someone who was a fan of a team with lots of Russian players was he had a translator who translated like Russian news and coverage, and also covered. At least the Capitals.
Yeah, this guy Dmitry Chesnikov I knew going back because he covered
a great job.
Yeah, he covered the Capitals. He's got a journalism background, and he would do two things. He would take Russian publications and translate stories for us, and then we would run the translation. And then he would also interview Russian players in Russian where they're more comfortable, and then translate those interviews into English. And you know, one of the biggest, you know, first things that we had on the blog was this guy Alexander Semin, who used to play for the Capitals, was talking about Sidney Crosby, the most famous hockey player in the world, and said that he was a piece of dead wood or driftwood or something like that. Like he just is a
something lost in the
transition. Yeah, a boring player, and like that became a huge thing. So Dmitry does a great job.
He also said all these awesome. So Alex Semin used to live in Arlington, like amazing things about Americans and their huge homes and their laziness. And
it's great because
it was great.
These guys are so much more comfortable talking in Russian than they are in English, and we get so much more information out of them. But it did lead to some very interesting journalistic questions, and I've had this fight many a time, which is if you have a Russian publication,
right.
You have two options. Three options. You either know Russian and can translate it yourself. You either know someone who knows Russian and they can translate it for you, or you cut and paste it into Google Translate and hope that it is somewhat accurate. And so the third option is 98% of the translated stuff that you read in sports media from Russian outlets,
seriously,
Swedish outlets.
That's terrible.
And it's terrible. Right. Exactly. Don't do it. And like you'll see disclaimers on blogs and other publications where it's like Google Translate might be a little rough. And I'm like, might be a little rough. he called one of his opponents a speedboat. I mean, like, I don't think that's accurate. So, but the real journalist.
It's an idiom that doesn't right. translate.
Yeah. The journalistic question for me was, if Dmitry Works For Me translates this Russian article into English, mm-hmm. okay, and now the fair use part of it is in some cases non-starter because he works for Sovietsky Sport in Russia. Like, he works for that paper. So in other words, he's sort of like part of that journalism, part of that organization. So if we take an article from them, translate it in English, he's a translator. He's got the Russian down. It's an accurate translation. Then someone else plucks that translation off our right. site and uses it and credits it to the original source rather than us. Then what do you do? That's been a fight I've had a thousand. I don't know the real answer. I know I get pissed off about it because, like, I feel like my guy put in the work.
Well, and some major journalism outlets have done this.
Yeah.
They've co-opted. Like, this, to me, is worse than just kind of co-opting some random paragraph from
right.
your blog piece. I mean, we transcribe here. I mean, I can only imagine how long it takes to translate something.
I've had this debate with people who I think have stolen content from us in that case by mm-hmm. not crediting the source.
I mean, all they have to do is link.
Well, yeah.
Well, but you also could put the name of the publication in there as well.
Well, to me, like, the proper sourcing is name of the publication and the person who translated it. And they're like, well, why should we source you? I mean, you didn't write the story. I'm like, yeah, but if you didn't have our translation, it would look like Zaf Dingbats. I mean, it would look yeah. like nothing to you. It would just be yeah. like just symbols and things. Like, you wouldn't know what it said. This happened the other day with Yamir Yager on his Facebook page in Czech.
Czech.
He wrote something about how this will be my last season. And I was tipped to that by someone who, I guess, did a rough translation. I sent it to a guy that we worked with who speaks Czech. He translated that passage for us. I published it with a banner headline with the quote in it. And then miraculously after we did that, a lot of people found the same quote, despite the fact that it was in Czech. and miraculously, their translation was very much close to ours. I don't know the answer. I do know that, you know, my biggest pet peeve as a journalist, and especially as some guy who, you know, is blessed with an audience and some influence and the you know, having broken some news here and there, I don't understand not giving credit. I just don't. Like, who cares? Like, no one is going to be like, oh, you saw it first in the New York Times and then did your own reporting on the story.
Yeah.
Well, then you're worthless. I'll just read the New York Times.
Yeah.
Like, it becomes a thing where it just becomes petty. And, you know, one of the things that we always do is credit other sources. Like, if mm-hmm. we're inspired to write something by something we read on Reddit, like, or find something cool on Reddit or a message board, we'll just say we found it there. Who cares? Like,
yeah. Transparency.
Yeah, transparency. And then ultimately it's what you do with what you find that really makes it worthwhile. But, like, every morning we write stuff that then inspires other reporting, but then, you know, most of the time it never tracks back to us because maybe the assumption is that people know where it came from, or maybe my assumption is that, like, they don't want to credit the original source because they can seem like they've done all the work themselves.
Or they're afraid somehow that the people are going to go there for their news. And
yeah,
stuff,
I don't
which
know.
Is,
it's
you know,
just stupid and petty.
Yeah, it's sort of a different.
But again, like, that's such a first world problem that we have.
Yeah,
I can't really
more or less
carp about it too much.
So just sort of to wrap up the discussion here on journalism, sports journalism, you know, how things sort of changed in the last few years and where do you see things sort of going at this point?
Well, the good news for people like me who came into blogs and alternative media at a time when it wasn't readily accepted is that it's now readily accepted. I mean, bloggers are getting mainstream jobs. Mainstream outlets have blogs. The entire form is gaining a level of acceptance, which is great. And, you know, I used to be one of these guys that fought the good fight on credentialing, for example, for events. And now it's become a thing where, you know, most of the bloggers that I know have some association with a major media company. And that takes away the biggest obstacle for a lot of these teams and organizations on credentialing for events, which is, well, who do I go to if you write something that's not true? who do I sue? I'm like, well, you would sue the company that pays me mm-hmm. for doing this because I'm not in my mom's basement. You know what I mean? So that's a huge change, and I think that's only going to get better. My biggest concern for the form of media that I practice is that there is a dumbing down of it to the point where now it's like the speed of coverage for all of us.
Right.
But the
this
speed
isn't
of
just sports. This
yeah,
is
the speed of coverage, I think, has really led to bad habits.
Well, the cutting and pasting that you were just saying.
Well,
that's
but even worse than that, building stories off of quotes on Twitter.
Oh, my God.
I mean, no context. No, what did he look like when he said it? Was he winking? Was he – I mean, like
– it's just, build,
yeah, building entire stories off of a quote on Twitter that you didn't acquire.
It's sort of not even just dumbing down, but sort of an evaporation of what news judgment was.
Yeah.
What is a story? What makes a story anymore? I think it's
yeah.
it's ephemeral anymore.
Right. And I think the speed of it has also killed some creativity, and the creativity is what brought me to this medium. And I think what brought a lot of us to this medium is, you know, don't just tell me the news, but tell me what it means to you, or tell me what your personal take on it, or give me the context that you can give me that I can't get anywhere else. And I feel like now we're at a point, not only in sports writing, but in other writing, where it's because we're all competing with the Huffington Post and with BuzzFeed and with places that are – with other media sites that are more about the make sure that you get the first name as the first word in the headline, and then you just put some stuff underneath it, and then we'll get a click off of the Google search. Like, I really feel like it's completely drained a lot of places of creativity, and I strive to keep that torch lit on our site, as I do the – I think the other Yahoo Sports bloggers are the same way, where we don't want to settle for rewriting a story from another newspaper just so we can have that headline on our site and you'll click it and think that you're getting something of value. The biggest term for me blogging in 2013 or 14 is added value. Like, please add value to what you're writing, because otherwise I read Twitter and can see the thing that you saw, and I don't need to read your reinterpretation of it, or just, you know, treading water around it until some other piece of information comes down the line.
Yeah.
Don't tell me more to come on stories that aren't like huge breaking natural disaster news. I mean, wait until there is more. You know what I mean? So the added value thing to me has been lost in some ways in digital journalism in 2013, just because it's such a rat race to try to make sure that your story is up first. And at the end of the day, it drains that medium of all of the interesting stuff that people came to it for. And it's a shame.
You got to put something in if you're going to take something out.
Yeah, or just wait a second until the story develops.
Yeah,
you know, because that's the other thing too. Is like people are so quick to write the first story that when the story gets corrected, they don't write the second story.
Yeah,
you know, and then it's just out there. So
it sucks.
It does suck.
It does suck. Okay, well, this has been great. Thanks for coming in.
No
and
problem
about this. It's been great.
Been waiting to come on.
Yeah, I've been waiting for you to come on.
Thank you. Because
I wasn't. The door was not barred.
Whatever. Very busy.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Off the look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.